Well, we have a lot of stuff here this morning again. Map on the board no one can read, especially if you're sitting in the back. So kind of the big highlighted ones are the important ones. But, you know, Life of David, we're doing the Life of David right now, or part of the Life of David, as I'll explain. But Life of David is always interfaced with the life of Saul and his family. And, you know, this goes back and forth and all that kind of gibberish is we're getting sorted out in our class. We did finish with Saul last week with his death, and now we're going to pick up with David in his life up to when he becomes, takes over Jerusalem. That's the idea. So our overall scheme of our lesson is the Bible as a contract. I'm not going to go over all this because I don't have time to, but just want to remember that the Bible is a contract, and we have a great perspective to see how the contract worked out. God said something. Just what did he mean? And I think in our idea here is that we have discovered that whatever he said in the contract is exactly what he meant. And it's a surprise to us. Well, it's a surprise to some. It's not what he meant. So, but we have observed so far that it has worked out just like he said it would. So we have our task. Talk about the Bible as a contract. Another kind of contract is an insurance policy. It's a contract. You sign it. Company stands behind what they've signed. All right. So you would think, if you lived in eastern Nebraska and were flooded by the cyclone bomb, that you know that for the last 20 years you have been paying the premiums for flood insurance. So you make the call to the claims office, and when you are told you are foolish to take the terms of the policy that way, in other words, literally, everyone knows that these insurance policy terms are figures of speech. Follow me here. Flood insurance really means that you have fire insurance. Flood keeps fires from spreading, doesn't it? That is what it means. You have flood insurance against fires. You had no fire, therefore you are not entitled to compensation. Now, I mix that up a little bit because when man writes a contract, we have a tendency to want to believe what he meant, and we have lawyers to enforce what you meant. So it's ridiculous, yes, when man writes a contract, but are we to suppose that when God writes the contract that man is more clear and more reliable than God? When we read that God gave the land to Abraham forever, are we to believe no such thing? God was only honoring the faith that he would get the land. That is what God meant. A typical flood for fire insurance switch. What are we to make of this kind of contract? What do we make of this kind of contract maker? What do we think about this kind of deception? Well, no one who has lost their property in the flood will accept this explanation. He'll say, I'll see you in court, I suppose. When they speculate about the meaning of God's contract, we're dealing with much more serious matters than just property losses. We're destroying the very word of God, just as sure as Satan did in the garden when he suggested that there's another way of looking at what God said. Can't take him literally, Remy. So, John, are you here this morning? I saw you walk in. I give you credit for this, pointing out this verse this week. Our job, and it's sort of like I thought, that's exactly what we're doing in our class here. We are destroying speculations of every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. Knowledge of God is the written, literal word of God, nothing else. And we are taking every thought captive that's outside of that, or what we might come up with, in obedience to Christ. So anything beyond the literal, normal literal talk puts our discussion about the knowledge of God into speculation and raised up speech against God and knowledge of him. And we, please abandon your speculation. And it's so hard to do. It is so hard to do in the theological realm. For one reason, is that it takes such a long time for this to work out. And by the time, you know, 2,000 years later, God's forgotten what he said. Certainly he's not going to force what he said 2,000 years ago, so we can sort of go on our own and imagine what he did. And we really don't want to obey him anyway, so that doesn't help. So we have this task to defend the word of God in apologetic form, and I say that the best way to look at the Bible is as a contract, and it's enforceable just like any other contract, like an insurance policy is, and so forth, like flood insurance. These are early ones. So we have moved through the contract, and we found it so far. Everything we have discovered is that it was literal. God made a contract with Abraham. It had a seed or land aspect to it. We've worked it through to the end, stayed with the land. Now we're working on the seed part. The seed has two aspects to it. We have a general seed, which would be plural. All those seeds that come from Abraham through different mothers, all are blessings to Abraham, and they're counted like the sands of the sea or the stars of the sky. But it also has an aspect of it. We find out that God meant also that there was one of those seeds is going to be very special. And that's why we get to David. And we don't know about that yet because we've not got to that point in David's life where we know that he is going to be the carrier of that seed onto the Messiah. So we kind of know that ahead of time, but we're not going to talk about it yet because we don't know that in our study. So we look for the search of the seed, and it's based on this idea that prophecy is literal. It wasn't a past fulfilled literally in the past. So if we find a seed that is a candidate, it's pretty easy to falsify it. It just has to have one thing wrong about it, this person, one thing. So the task of falsification, the false ones, are easy. And once you find the right one, it's impossible to falsify it. Everything is true. Everything is true, then you can't falsify it. So we have that as our task, our job. We pick up where we left off with Saul's death. We have him dying in the Valley of Jezreel. Well, not really. He's actually on the Mount of Gilboa overlooking the Valley of Jezreel. So we have this battle with the Philistines that led to Saul's death was intended to end the nation of Israel. This has always been an idea of every one of the neighbors of Israel, to put them out of business, to drive them into the sea, to destroy them from the face of the earth. And the Philistines had the same intent. I guess that's how wars are fought, especially in the Middle East and especially against Israel. So we have this battle, and it's going on in the northern part of north central part of Israel. And it's the Philistines. They move along the coastal region. These are these red arrows here. They move along the coastal region along the Shephelah. That's what that range is called, the Shephelah Range. That's against the seashore of the Mediterranean, to the center of the country, where in the middle of the flat valley called Jezreel Valley, Armageddon Valley, all that and other names for it, Megiddo Valley, Megiddo, they could utilize their chariots. So, I mean, if you're going to fight somebody, you're going to pick your battleground, right? Well, if you have chariots, you don't want to go into the hill country. So you drive your army into the place where they have the best advantage. Now, I've got one caveat here because I don't know how to answer this, because usually in the valley, we have made a point that it's mud and swampy, and it's very difficult to fight there because of the lowness of it. And that becomes the issue why Megiddo and Hazor are critical points in the controlling the world, because you had to go through these points because they were on kind of high points and the bridge, that valley of mud. But we've got a battle going on here. So I can't explain exactly how that worked. Maybe it's a certain time of year when it was drier, or maybe they fought it on the edges, whatever. But the idea that you could run your chariots here was what apparently motivated the Philistines to come here. And I don't want to worry about the mud with the chariots, so they don't go together either. So somehow that works out. All right. So they come to this place, which I've got circled there. It's close to Endor, the Witch of Endor. Remember that one? So we're in Mount Gilboa, Jezreel, the spring, Bethshean is over here, the Gentile city. So let's see. I read that to you. All right. Next one. So Saul's death battle, we have noticed that his pointed out that where he died would be on this hill here on the top of Gilboa, and that's about where we're looking, the last picture coming up at you. And so this whole area down here is where you would have had the place where the battle could have occurred, and right off to the left over here is where we have Shunem and the Witch of Endor's home. So you see Saul could have made that trip at night to go visit with her later. Before the battle was done. So the Israelites were confined to the hill country, which they always were. Not the best place to be, but it was the safest place for them to be. Ending up in Mount Gilboa in the north, overlooking the Jezreel Valley. There apparently was a Philistines' plan to engage the Israelites there, since it was quite a trip. You saw that trip, all those arrows. They had quite a trip to the valley from the area we know today as the Gaza Strip. That's where they came from. Now, Achish is the king of the Philistines here, the leader, general, whatever. knew that if he could drive Israelites north from the divide the Israelites north from the south, that he could have the advantage to take one half and then the other half, you know, to the split and conquer maneuver in battle. Saul apparently knew of the imminent danger, having lost God's favor. So serious did he see this last battle that he felt compelled to consult the dead Samuel at Endor. Not so bad off he was. Well, David should have been helpful here. After all, he was a military genius. But jealousy with David, Saul's jealousy with David, made him no good to Saul. So just when Saul could have used David and his army of 600, he was banished to the south and was taken in by, of all people, the Philistines. I'm sorry. Yes, the Philistines, the enemy of Israel. And he lives there, I don't know how long. He becomes actually the bodyguard of Achish, yes, thank you. Now I'm mixed up where I am. Why am I looking at this already? Well, that's the battle place. All right, we looked at it already. So here we go. David makes friends with an Amalekite king, Achish. That's a mistake. That's Philistine king, Achish. That's wrong. I thought I corrected all of mine. David makes friends with the Philistine king, Achish, who expects David to join him against Saul. Now we think about, whoa, we know David really, Achish is really making a mistake here. Why would David join against Saul? Well, Achish, you know, whatever. That's what he thinks. So he even makes David his bodyguard. I mean, David could have killed him any time. I mean, just that's what bodyguards can do. But Achish's general do not trust this alliance and forces Achish to send David back to Ziklag, which I have marked on your map. Well, actually, this saves Achish's life because otherwise David would have had to kill him eventually and honors David in not fighting Saul. So David never gets into a skirmish with Saul. As these fights go on, it's always one-sided. And David runs away. In fact, he even takes refuge in the enemy here, not to get killed by Saul. But when David returns to Ziklag, and this is a hard journey back, the Amalekites, that's where the mistake was made, the Amalekites have taken the women and children, all of them. The men exhausted in returning to Ziklag blame David for going against Achish, the Philistines, leaving the families undefended. Who else gets the blame but the leader? Of course. So David writes various parts of the Psalms as a memory of these low days. We could have stopped and looked at some of these Psalms. You might want to do that. It probably is sometimes noted when he wrote those Psalms. So this is one of his low times. So David regains strength, goes after the Amalekites, stops them so they are never heard from again for 300 years. I guess that's a dead stop. And they recapture their lost family to a person. No one is lost in this thing. Well, that sets well with the people that David is going to lead. So we see where Ziklag is. They don't know for sure where it is. They got two spots that are known there. And it's kind of the area that we looked at recently as the Valley of Elah in that region. Well, to unify the nation, remember Saul is dead, and the victory put David back in good grace with his own army, and from here on the road leads to the royal throne, but it's not exactly smooth. He is appointed here as king over the southern tribes, actually Judah and Simeon, only two, but there are housekeeping duties before the nation is unified in the capital, no Jerusalem yet, before the capital is secured. And I'll show you a burial of Hebron or Hebron, however you want to say it. And the best I can figure out, we're looking somewhat to the south, northeast. So over the edge here, over the edge over here would probably be the Jordan River Valley because the way the sun is oriented shadows, not my picture, of course, we have our back to the west and we're looking kind of towards the east. All right, so these are the tombs of Abraham and Sarah and others that are buried in Hebron, and that's why I know that's the right place, because we've been there, and that's what it looks like. Now it's somewhat under the quasi-control of the Palestinians or the Arab League, or the Arab, not what they call them, Palestinian Authority. Okay, David reigns, I call slowly. He slowly gets into the job. It would have been difficult for David to directly assume the absolute leadership as king after Saul. Remember, there's been a first king. Now he's the second king, and it's not the family of Saul. Now there was one son, Isbosheth, who had the mantle due to his heritage. Now I put him on the map over here, You have Saul, Ishbosheth, and I have him killed by Benjamites, but that's where he fits. So actually we have one surviving, most of these guys are dead by now, most of them, one surviving son that would be a legitimate heir to Saul. And so he starts to reign. Remember that God took away his reign and his dynasty, but we still have one reigning here for a little bit. So, like I say, some housekeeping duties have to be done here. So we have one, and then we have one grandson of Saul, Jonathan. He's on the end over here. Saul has son Jonathan, a friend of David. Remember, those are good friends. Couldn't draw that line over there. But he has a son Mephibosheth, and what's strange about him? He was lame because his nurse had dropped him. And when you get dropped by the nurse, you're got broken feet. So apparently broke his legs or feet or ankles or something. And of course, those days he couldn't fix it, so he ends up being a cripple the rest of his life. So he's not really a contender for the throne. You would have deformed people, rain and those kind of things. You can't go to battle, so he's really never a threat. He doesn't die violently. In fact, he is taken in later on by David because of his relationship to Jonathan, who was a friend. So we have only one, really, that we know of that survives, Saul, that could have been a king, but he's really out of the league to be a king. So in a sense, we'd say there are none. So you have one grandson, which is that son of Jonathan. So for a short time, Saul's son, him, Ishbosheth, reigns for 40, who was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. And then, by the way, on the rest of the verse says, but the house of Judah followed David, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Well, lest we think all this is plotted out by David and arranged for by a wise king elect, we stand corrected. David's not running the show here. God is. So as the news of Saul's death comes to David, after he's recovered the families from the Amalekites, he does the godly thing and asks direction from the Lord. And he asked, and it came about after that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah? Now, where should I have my headquarters? And the Lord said to him, go up. And David said, well, where should I go? And he said, to Hebron. So all this is directed by the Lord, a different slant to things than when Saul was in charge. Well, with the death of Saul, the way is cleared for David to begin his dynastic calling, although that calling is not yet given. I don't want to get ahead of our story. He is king for only Judah, in other words, the south. And we'd consider it an undivided Israel at this point, although kind of technically it is. But divided, usually we talk about Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So he is the only king in Judah, in the south, in the undivided kingdom. This is his, by default, or near vacuum leadership. If it wouldn't have been David, who would it have been? Well, the other possibility would be Ishbosheth, and well, we know that he does claim some of it. Now, David has notoriety from the days of killing Goliath many years ago now, but those things stick with you as a warrior. And his reputation as a military leader makes him an easy choice, but traditions withstand. So it's not easy for him to walk into it because we have Ishbosheth sitting there yet claiming it. And he's got an army. So David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. Then the men of Judah came and there anointed David king over the house of Judah, and they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. So now David is finding out what happened to Saul, that he was killed. And we have the place Bethshean on your right, and the Philistines killed him there, and the people from Jabesh-Gilead is right across here, maybe 10 miles away, what we call in today's Jordan. And they took the body, you know that story. Well, so in a conciliatory action here, David sent messages to Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul, our Lord, and have buried him. Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now Saul and the Jabesh-Gilead people have a relationship because Saul sort of rescued them from some of the stupid things they have done. And I forget exactly how the story goes. I was going to reread that, and I didn't. So you probably know the story better than I do. So Saul was sort of a special person for them because of what he had done for them. And they don't want to forget that. And David is honoring that. So he's offering reconciliation here or conciliatory language here so they could be brought into his reign. And now, therefore, let your hands be strong. be valiant, for Saul, your lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So, you know, would you join us? But, what is the word in there, but? But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, which is on the Jordanian side, and made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, basically all over northern Israel. That finally, instead of listing all the places, the writer just cuts it short. So, as it always is in these reigns, if you don't have the military with you, you don't have a reign. And so Abner actually takes control, and he's not the king, but if you're the military guy, we've got that going on in Venezuela right now, don't we? As long as the military stays with whatever his name is, he's not going to be toppled. But as soon as the military gives way, the guy's gone. So the king depends on the military. Well, in this case, the military Abner guy takes the role of the king and overrules this idea that David suggests. So then we say, well, who is really the king then? We have a kind of a military commander king now under the name of Abner. All right, so I read that on the right already. And we did that. At this time, David was king over Hebron and over the house of Judah. So we have this division pretty much there. And that's where Benjamin starts. And basically everything to the north and even across the Jordan River, we have the area now claimed by Abner, I should say. Mahanaim is here. Mahanaim, is that kind of like the steamroller guy? Kind of like that. I think that's in Germany, though. But it's kind of like that name. All right. So, and he was there 6 months. All right. Did we read that? Yeah. The time of David was 6 months. A year and six years and 6 months. Seven and a half years. Now, just to pause here to think a little bit, all this trouble happened because Israel wanted a king too soon. So it's a sad thing in Israel to see the divisions and a civil war looming. Ishbosheth is killed by his tribal opportunists later on. His own people, his own Benjamites kill him. Abner, loyal to Saul, selfish, big letter selfish, is not particularly in tune with what God's plan are for the nation. So he does what all nations or all kings do in the case of the death of the king. The transfer of power is the greatest testing ground for our nation to avoid civil war. And by the way, we have that going on in our country right now. It's a transfer of power. It happens to be a bloodless, so far, battle that's going on with transfer of power. Whenever there's a transfer of power, there's always instability. You know, the other one doesn't really want to know that they're not in charge anymore. So you have this pushback. We have that. It happens all the time. You look in the story of England, you know, if ever anybody came to the throne, if you were a brother of that king, you probably, you know, head for the hill country because you were in his targets or his children and everybody else was subject to being put to death except the one guy that's the king. So these transfer power issues are big, and Israel has a transfer power that wasn't necessary. They didn't need Saul. Saul wasn't necessary. But because they wanted it, we got all this trouble. And we're going to talk about all the killing that goes on. And this one killed this one. This one killed this one. This is revenge killing. This was, you know, David kind of stands aloof to all of this, and he really does. But there's a lot of killing going on because of the wickedness of the people wanting a king when God said, not yet. But they said, I'll give you one. You go, you get what you want, and this is what you get. So don't blame God for any of the stuff that's happening here, right? Sometimes we do. Well, all this killing, this doesn't seem right. It's not right. But who's at fault here? Okay. So this transfer of power is a very delicate time for a nation. So Abner is guilty of not following David and it will cost him his life. Abner will not survive this. Well, that's on the board. It's on the board over here. I don't need to. If I need this, I'll come back. Last week, I think I showed you Gibeon. And I said this is where it's born. And it's where Joshua didn't fit the Battle of Jericho, but where he saw the sun stand still because they needed more daylight to win. Well, we're in that area now, and it's Gibeon, and there's the well here. They call it a pool. It's quite remarkable. We didn't get to see it. I wish I would have. I don't know why it didn't take us there. We were within 100 feet of it. That's what you get when you get poor guides. But then they don't know what we want to know either. So anyway, here we have this place. We're going to fix this problem. We've got Ishbosheth and David. And to fix this problem is to have some people duke it out. That's what we have here in 2 Samuel 2:12. Now, Abner, son of Ner, went out from Nanaim to Gibeon, to this place. And by the way, it's just in that seam between the north and the south, David and Saul, Ishbosheth's area. In that seam, and Joab and the son of Zeruiah and servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down one on one side of the pool and one side, on the other side of the pool. Can you just imagine? I don't have a very good picture of this. There's a little better one of the pool, you know, we could see, you know, where they actually could sit on one each other side. By the way, this is a water, obviously it's a water system, and it's very deep. I think it's 80 feet deep, I read here. And what you see is not the bottom of it. It goes down further yet. So these things are built on a hill. And so if you have the pool's access at the top of the hill, you got to go down through the hill to the table, water table. It's, you know, quite a ways, and it's quite a task. And it has to be done if a city ever is under siege. So as I told you, that Gibeon is sitting right kind of between these two places. All right, so you were where we are, just north of Jerusalem, in fact. If you're in Jerusalem, you can look up and see that from the Mount of Olives. I pointed that to you last week. Now, I didn't write this, and I got a question about what they said here. So in 1956, the Pool of Gibeon was discovered 6 miles north of Jerusalem. Now, this next tunnel, I think, cannot be right. A tunnel runs from the pool to Jerusalem. That'd be a 6-mile tunnel. I've never heard of such a thing. So I think there's something wrong with the editing here. But it is an astonishing 80 feet deep and was dug sometime before 1000 BC. So sometime before David, this was already there, which makes sense because now we have David and he's sitting there. All right. On the right here, we have, this is that hill we see from Gibeon where the battle was fought when the sun stood still. And then we look further up higher and we see Ramallah today, which is the area of the Palestinian Authority headquarters where Hamas reigns supreme. So we're in that very, very close proximity to modern day terror. There's our pool of, and I'm looking now again where the battle would have been fought. I can't tell because there are, somewhere over here probably is where that little mound would have been. Not going to have to point that out, but we're looking to the north. Okay, so we're talking about these two sides. So this is what I call a diplomatic war. You go and you go. You duke it out and I'll watch. Now, that's called a diplomatic war. In a diplomatic war, both sides selected 12 soldiers to fight to the death. The winner would take all. Instead of sending everybody out, just send these 24. But the contest was indecisive. All the participants died. They each got a hold of each other and killed each other. I mean, that's almost miraculous that they all got killed. They all killed each other. He's like, I killed you and you killed me at the same time? They're all dead. So it's inconclusive when these all participants die. So civil war continues with the loss of many lives, and these probably sent their best. We've already had the Saul's three sons of Saul, Jonathan, Abinadab, and I didn't pronounce his name, died with him at Mount Gilboa. Ishbosheth became king of Israel at age 40. We know that. Now Abner kills Azael, and he's on the list over here. Abner kills Azael. Azael chases Abner. He doesn't like what Abner's doing. And Abner turned around and kills him. So I guess in somewhat self-defense. But shouldn't have done that. So that's a nephew of David over here. You see where David fits. It's a sister's son. So it'd be a nephew. Azael was a nephew of David. So Abner moves to be king, takes Saul's concubine, Rizba. And she's up there. All right, so that's sort of a move that supersedes Ishbosheth. Whenever somebody takes the concubines of the former king, you're taking his property. And he's then ahead of Ishbosheth. So that puts Ishbosheth in, you know, bad straits. Ishbosheth understands Abner's move to unseat him. Ishbosheth rebukes Abner. Abner's hurt. Oh, I'm sorry, it hurt my feelings. Well, anyway, he turns and supports David now. And it really ends up Ishbosheth's hope for being king. Now, David and Abner make an agreement, which is one of these kind of unholy alliances. What is the political alliances? You make the best of worst deals. You know, you make your best deal of the worst deals rather than make a good deal. You don't ever make a good deal in a political alliance. So you make the best of the bad deals. Good. Yours. So that's what David's doing with Abner, apparently. He receives him back. And under this condition, he wants to get his wife back that was taken from him, was a promise to him by Saul. So Michal is up there as his wife, and she's somewhere down there. I don't know, did I put her up there? Yeah, there we go, down there. All right, so they're reunited, have no children, and we know the story. We'll get into the story later on when the ark comes back to Jerusalem, or comes to Jerusalem. David is dancing, and she's critical of his antics, and he doesn't like her criticism. So apparently he never had sex with her again, you know, put her off, and no children from her. So there's no children from Saul from her. Again, another interesting thing that God has ordained, no children from her. Because no children, that would be the descendant of Saul, then, wouldn't it? So none of those. So Ishbosheth understands Abner's move to unseat him. Ishbosheth rebukes Abner. Abner hurts, changes side to support David, ending Ishbosheth's hopes. Now Abner, David and Abner agree and give back Michal, daughter, Saul's daughter, given to him as his wife. Now Abner delivers Benjamin. Remember, he's from the Benjamites, to David's rule. So Abner, the king, in a sense, ruling king, you know, has authority to bring the whole tribe into David's rule. So for this, David elevates Abner further. And we're not done yet. Joab, over here, is the general for David, is loyal to David, sees Abner a threat. Can you imagine? So Joab, David's general, is angered, arranges a meeting in Hebron, and by stealth, murders him. He says, I got something to tell you. Pulls his head down, jabs him in the stomach, kills him. Well, that angers David because he shouldn't have done this. For one thing, it's in a refuge city. You don't do that, I guess. That's one of the rules. And he honors Abner in a great funeral. And Joab's, David's half-sister's son, but he doesn't get punished. So Joab sort of gets away with murder. Maybe that's where it came from. I don't know, that little expression. But he does get away with murder. But you think of the overall scheme of things, you can't have Abner hanging around this new reign of David. I mean, he'd be a problem all the time because he's a fickle guy. He first of Ishbosheth takes over, you know, makes a deal with David. You don't trust a guy like that. So the best thing is to remove him, but you can't have David responsible for it. That would look bad. So Joab does it. And Joab can't be punished because he's just too good a guy. In a sense, he really needed to do it anyway because Abner had killed his nephew over here, Aziel, earlier. So you see, these revenge killings just go on. It's hard to keep track of all of this, right? God has kept track of it. So anyway, here we have all of David's family. I'm just going to point out to you that these are the wives of David. We have eight listed here, and these are the children from these mothers. And we get down to Bathsheba, and we see, I don't think this has to be in order. Can't be in order. If it is, I'm learning something here because we have Solomon last. I didn't think he was last. But anyway, that's how they have it. And then we have mothers that are not listed here as concubines. And there's another eight listed here, sons, plus other sons of concubines. And we have none of the girls listed. So double everything. And that's how many children come out of David's family. And now we understand that's different than what we do today. And there was purposes for it those days that was allowed. But anyway, David had a huge family. Lots of people, just to say that. Well, Ishbosheth reigned 2 years, but after the death of Abner was killed by two of his own captains, and they were Benjamite tribal members. Now, David doesn't like this. I mean, don't want him killed, Ishbosheth killed. David does not see this any more honorable than the Amalekite who had killed Saul in a mercy killing, and he paid for his life, and so these guys pay for the life as well. So how much more, David says, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house and his own bed, shall I now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the face of the earth? So anyway, they get killed. No one gets away with that. Only one that really gets away with anything here is Joab. Yes. So, a little bit of rundown here, and we're running out of time, as I knew we would. Okay, these were a lot of times vengeance killings without David acting as an accessory to any of these crimes. But in the end, there was no challengers to David's ascent to the throne, although one son, Jonathan's, Saul's grandson survives, got him down there, the crippled-footed person. Perhaps he is kept alive in honor of David and Jonathan's friendship. He is crippled in his feet, probably is not a real threat because of that, and really becomes a ward of the kingdom. David takes care of him, probably out of love for his father, Jonathan. So when all the tribes came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you are the one who led Israel out and in," like the king or the army. "And the Lord said to you, 'You will be shepherd of my people, Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel.'" So they're coming on shore here. "So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron. There they anointed David over king over Israel. And David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years, 6 months. Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over Israel and Judah. With Ishbosheth's death, David's involvement, the kingdom can proceed to unity under one king, which is the project. Remember, we had this first king was a problem in God's mind. So all of this, again, I'll say it again a third time, all of this trouble because they wanted a king. Wouldn't have had any of this happen. All right, so don't blame God for this. So all this anguish because people wanted a king before God's timing in it. And I say, are there lessons here? Of course there are. But is Hebron the place? Well, it's not the center of the earth, but there are Jebusites that live there at the center of the earth. They have never been dislodged since the days of Joshua now, which is 500 years ago. Was this an oversight? Probably not, just not needed yet. But now to place the capital in a neutral zone, neither Benjamin nor Judah could claim it or be proud of it. And it is also a very defendable site. The Jebus had it, and so that is selected, of course, by God. So all this is a divine choice. It is sure that Isaac was offered as a sacrifice on Mount Moriah, the same place where the Messiah, the son of David, will in fact be offered as a sacrifice, pictured in the Abrahamic and Isaac event. This is now 1,000 years later. The Lord's clock may run slow, but it is always on time, even to the second. So the Jerusalem site, coming up on it next, David had two intentions to locate here. One, that his palace would be there, which would be the administrative headquarters. And the second thing is to return and rejoin the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle. They have not been together since they've been separated at Shiloh quite a few hundred years ago. Here in the new capital for the people, the Ark had been at Shiloh, but had been stolen by the Philistines. Now it had been returned to Israeli territory. It has been at or nearby Jerusalem in the house of Abinadab. Now remember, the Ark and the Tabernacle are different things. You know what the differences are. They're not together. You wonder how they functioned. Saul's death makes way for the son of Jesse, the great-grandson of Ruth, of the thousands of descendants of Judah. Of the thousands of descendants of Judah, we are going to come down to one eventually. David will be selected as the one to begin the dynasty and move it forward to the Messiah. David nor anyone else knows this. No one knows this. When it comes to David, it will be a complete surprise. Next week, we'll look at the life of David as the king of Israel. And we'll deal with historic Jerusalem then. And my finger just moved to the end of time. But if there's a comment or a question, after rushing through the lesson this morning, I didn't want to split that up. Okay, how about the lesson of don't ask for a king? And when you do, look what happens. Wouldn't that be a pretty good lesson? Don't ask for things you shouldn't have.
Well, they already had a king.
No. Well, yeah, that's right. And they said, told Samuel, they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they're rejecting me. And they got Saul. So the lesson is, don't ask for something you shouldn't have. Because you ask for, you know, have we thought about that? If I ask for this, I might get it.
But this reminds me of an episode of Keystone Cops.
I know. See, I'm not going to say this about you, Tom, but we all pick up history where we are. The homeless guy picks up history where he's sitting there without a home. We said, well, why didn't you get a job and you wouldn't be homeless? So everybody wants to pick up where we are today. Well, that poor guy or these guys, well, look what these people died because. But remember, God holds people accountable for decisions they made earlier.
And we want to go back. Well, that was bad. They just made a mistake. You know, forgive them their stuff. Well, that's called grace. God does a lot of that. But I think the lesson is here, don't ask for something that's not yours. And when they get it, they have this tremendous trouble, anguish, to get out of it. What's he sound like? He sounds like one of the guys that lived in the time before they had Saul as king. He said, we need a king. And I would say, well, you got God. You just said it. We got God as your king. What's wrong with that? And the next answer is, well, we're not like the other nations. They have kings. We don't have kings. Look how they function. They function perfectly. We function dysfunctionally. So if we had a king like they did, who functioned perfectly, which they didn't, then we'd be like them and we'd be perfect.
But God wants them to be a nation. He wants them to be a human.
Okay, let's do history. I like the questions because this is fundamental stuff. The fundamental thing is that God was going to be their king. You said it. It's called a theocracy. For 330 years, they tried that. Disaster upon disaster upon disaster. I think we had 12 judges. Disasters upon disaster, disaster. Then the people knew it was a disaster. And what did the people do? We need a king because we are tired of these disasters. If we have a king, we won't have these disasters anymore. That was the logic. And so God says, give him a king. Now we got this trouble. So I say, when we look at history, we always start out like, I always said goldfish, you got 2 seconds of memory. We always start with today, and we don't realize that there's history that got us here. And the last thing I want to know, and this is the flesh talking, the last thing I want to be reminded of are the mistakes that I made that got me here. I don't want to be reminded of that. I want that some other reason got me here. I mean, I was a victim of whatever. I didn't, you know, have opportunities, whatever. I'm here as a victim. Israel's not there as a victim. They're there by the consequence of their choice. And the people said they wanted a king, and God says, I'm going to give you a king. And then when the right king comes along, we got this tremendous upheaval of social life, carnage, military. How many hundreds of or thousands of people die as a result of this choice? So we don't want to go back and hold the blame there back there, but that's where you got to put it. You got to put it back there and let God work it out. And then so anyway, the life lesson to me is you got to do what God says. Don't ask for stuff you shouldn't have.
Amen to that.
It's a small thing, but my mother's mother, my grandmother, had a stroke when she was 40. She was, probably 60. My mother's the only child. And I remember she prayed so hard that God would not take her. My grandma was so bad, I thought, no, she's not going to live. She's not going to live. But she did. For another 20 years, guess who had to take care of her? But a broker. He said, well, be careful sometimes what we ask for. Now, I don't want to kill people. I don't want to do that. But, you know, in terms of really, we live in a real world. So we ask for things sometimes with all the sincerity of our heart and say, this is exactly what we need. And we forgot to ask God whether this is really what we should have. And when we persist in asking what we want, God might just, as a teaching moment, a pedagogical moment, let you have it. And then you pay the price for it. Vicki. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're going to take your daughters, your sons. They're going to take your money. They're going to tax you to death. And they're going to call it, they're going to steal your money. They're going to call it taxation. He had one quality, which you know what it is. Tell me. David had one quality. He was a man after God's own heart. And I tell you, when you have that, you're invincible. I'm not you, but you are in an invincible position. And we don't have it, you have it with Saul. And we do it my way. Now guess who wins? And we have trouble with the carnage. Joab did this to Abner. I said, and David didn't like it. But God said, that's what it's going to be. All right, well, that's good. I'd like the discussion. I sometimes, often, realize we don't learn from our history. Yes, Ford. Just think about David. Saul took over the kingdom there wasn't a shot fired, not an arrow shot, you know, not a javelin thrown. Saul took it over. David could have had that position. David could have had that position, but he didn't have it. So anyway, lesson is don't ask for something you shouldn't have because you'll pay the price for it when you get it.